Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is Tom Katowski, Healthy Referral Newspaper in sunny Cleveland, Ohio. Substituting for Marcia today, we are Healthy Referral on the Mind, Your Body, and Spirit Network, promoting holistic medicine, natural health, personal spiritual development. We have a special guest today, Cliff Ritchie. He was an iconic figure in the tennis world, but we're going to be talking about his powerful book that he wrote a number of years ago called Acing Depression, and we want to get into it right away. Cliff, are you there?
I'm here, Tom. It's nice to talk with you and all the people up there in Cleveland.
Yeah, and all over. I was fortunate to see you many years ago when you played Davis Cup in Cleveland, Ohio at Roxborough Junior High, which is amazing. You had the greatest players in the world at a junior high school in Cleveland. So that was amazing period way back then.
Yes, it was quite something that they would build a stadium there at that little junior high, but that was in large part due to Bob Malaga's work, who used to be a big shot in the USTA.
Yes. Bob was an iconic figure from bringing, putting Cleveland on the map with tennis. But for people, the listeners that are not familiar with your background, could you just explain a little bit about your, like a short little sketch on your background and how you got started in tennis and let's say the role of your dad in the whole development?
Yeah, we were a tennis family. Gosh, my dad, he was a tennis coach. He coached Rice University and played himself at a high level. And, of course, my sister, 4 years older than me, she has won a singles or a doubles at every one of the Grand Slams. A lot of people find that amazing. I do, too. But anyway, yeah, we were a tennis family, and it was there for me to do if I wanted to do it. And at a pretty young age, I decided that I wanted to try to become a good player. And, when I tell people what I've done in the game, I have like four or five quick things. I mean, I won the first ever world point title in 1970, beating Ash and Rosewall, Smith and Laver. I won the Davis Cup twice. I was number one in the United States, and really a title that I'm really proud of because I had a long layoff. I won the Senior Tour Championships in Los Angeles over Rod Laver in 1983.
Oh, wow. Okay. That was tremendous. Can you dive a little bit more, tell the listeners a little bit more about the influence that your dad had and what,
sure.
What was the, the ongoing, the initial motivation, the ongoing motivations once you get started, to try to keep the fun and the joy in the game while you're progressing, and then different things kind of may take you off that track. And can you, just speak on that and what influence your dad had and what you had to go through, like mentally, physically, spiritually, on the journey to even get to the high level?
Well, I mean, in our family, it wasn't just the tight little close-knit cozy family that maybe everybody thought. It was in many ways, because in my book, I talk about our family. I call it Ritchie Inc., INC, because that's all we did. We were tennis. I dropped out of high school to go on the tour, and my dad, he really encouraged me to go on the tour. As a matter of fact, he said, you'll probably teach it if you don't make it playing it. So he was not against me dropping out of school, and he was a great coach. He was rated as one of the best three coaches in the world. And, of course, then once you get out on the tour, you've got all the pressures and the stresses that anyone can imagine, and they're there. I tell everybody I've played 500 tournaments all over the world and 1,500 matches. And, it's live and in living color every time, and you get nervous every time. But my dad, I called him into many events when I felt like he could help me with my game, and he would fly in. And so that and my sister, we played the tour together before it went open, and the tours split off. So, and then, of course, in the latter part of my career, my game started to deteriorate, And that's when, for about the last 5 years of my main tour, the world tour, before I played the senior tour, I had some pretty bad clinical depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before we jump into that, can you just express what was it about your dad's lessons, teachings, that really stood out to you more so than other people in the tennis world that you have met over the years? What jumped out at you that really?
Well, my dad was a great motivator, and he also, he basically said to me, he said, you know, if you want to play the game, and I was 12 years old, he said, you know, if you really want to be serious, I'll give you all I got. But he said, you've got to do the same. And and yet if I lost, he would, that's when, because I did give it everything I have, he'd congratulate my opponent first. He'd come over to me, pat me on the back, and say, we'll get him next time, kiddo. But he was a great motivator. He had an ability to look at any situation and flip it on its side and see it from a different angle. And you need to do that in any kind of stressful profession. And so, you know, I could go to him if I was feeling like I was getting choky before the match even started, and I could talk it out with him. And I'd say, you know, I'm not feeling that great about this. And we'd talk. And he was a great analyzer. He was also a great strategist. Because he played himself and got to be in the top 10 of the United States in the pro ranks back in the early 50s, he was a guy that truly understood every facet of the game. And my dad, in addition to being my coach, he was also Nancy and my agent in a way. He made deals for us once the game went open with corporations, and he managed our money. He was excellent as far as knowing how an athlete should handle their money. And so my dad was everything to me, and I still miss him.
Wow, that's very, very unique. I think more parents should be, supportive of their children and not try to force them into something that they're not passionate about.
Yes, that's very true. And the thing is that, you know, we were at a posh country club in Dallas when I dropped out of high school. He was the pro, you know, at Brook Hollow Golf Club in Dallas. And the members just couldn't believe that, you know, he was for me dropping out. But what people didn't understand, and even I had some relatives, you know, I grew up at the tennis shop, and I answered the phone. I helped my dad. I pumped balls for his lessons. And if I didn't make it playing, I was going to teach tennis for a living, because that's what I knew. So we had a backup plan, but my dad supported me, 1,000%, and he knew I had a gift for the game, and he thought, well, why not? You know, let's go for it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think your gift? What do you think was inside you that? On the ladder of tennis, people have no idea the different levels of tennis, and getting there is one thing, staying there is a whole other thing. So can you speak on the progression of even getting to that level once you're there, you know, mentally, spiritually, to stay there? Can you make a few comments on that?
Well, again, my dad, early in my career, my dad, when I started playing the big men's tournaments when I was about 16 or 17 years old, my dad instilled in me the thought or the idea or the passion, the dream, that if I went off to play in a tournament, it didn't matter who was in the tournament, Chuck McKinley, Arthur Ashe, it didn't matter. There to make an upset in the first round and beat somebody that was a named player. You were there to win the entire tournament. You weren't there just to win a few matches. And so my attitude was always, I've got more work to do. And, you know, I have told kids that I've practiced with through the years that these are some of the kids that thought they wanted to play the tour. You know, I said, look, there'll always be pressure on you when you play the tour in two ways. if you're on a losing streak, you need to get your game back and you're under the pressure to play well, let's say, the second or third week after you have not played so well. We all know what that pressure is. But what people don't think about sometimes is that if you've won two or three or four matches in a row and it takes, say, five matches to win the tournament, can you be mentally strong for that fifth match, or do you think you've done your job? Or even win a couple tournaments in a row, be committed to the third week in a row, and go in there and give it a professional performance and get up for it and be able to play from the mountaintop as well as the valley. So those are the pressures that you have to learn to deal with and know that they're there. And, you know, that's what a true pro is about. And you enjoy the fact that under any situation that you feel pressure, on a losing streak or a winning streak, you can still produce what you should.
Yeah, I heard Tony Nadal on a talk, and he talked when he was bringing Rafa up. He mainly just focused on, A, the appreciation of being there and the joy of the journey. But there had to be a deep appreciation for the ability to even do this. And he never once discussed the goal was winning. It was always
right.
about the joy and the attitude of being able to do it and having the privilege of even doing it. Could you, speak on that as far –
Yeah, that's so true. You know, my take was similar to that, but I'll put it in different words. What I enjoyed the most when I was a kid starting out was feeling the improvement in my game, and I could feel my skills getting better. That was a big kick. You know, my serve got a little better, in one period, and my ground strokes, and I learned how to move on the court a little better. And so then from there, rather than saying, okay, I've got these tournaments lined up and I have a desire to win this tournament or that tournament or whatever, no, what I always felt was that I enjoyed getting my skill at a high level, and I felt like if I did have it at a high level, that then I was capable of winning a tournament. But the goal was to get my skills at a high level, not necessarily winning a particular tournament.
And all along, and then who, I assume your dad advised you on continually what you needed to work on each, year along the journey and what he felt.
And I played the tour for 5 years in 1968, and I knew that I had to get my serve better, and my dad agreed with me, and I was well into my tour days. I was, 5 years in, and, I came off the tour, dropped off the Davis Cup team, and worked on my serve for like 3 or 4 months in the fall of 68. And in those days, you didn't have the fancy equipment. We did an 8-millimeter camera, but my dad was down there. We had a court in our backyard, and he was down there every day helping me with it. As I said, it was a family business, and my dad loved the game. Probably for me, it was a little bit more of sheer passion, and I was a very hyper person. I was a short sprinter. In other words, I'd play 2 or 3 weeks and then need a week or two off. My sister was the opposite. Mm-hmm. She could play 6 or 7 or 8 tournaments in a row and almost get better each week. Everybody's different that way, but I played a lot of events. I usually played 23 to 27 tournaments a year, and that's a lot, not counting exhibitions and Davis Cup.
The physical, mental, conditioning and, knowing when to ease up, when to take a break, when to step on the gas. That's not easy to figure that out. But just staying at your level for so long is an incredible accomplishment. Can you speak a little bit about your book called Acing Depression that you wrote a number of years ago, how that came about, the depression part of your career, I guess. And then, what led to that, and what message did you have, you know, in your book that you want to have out there?
Well, for me, losing the skill that I was talking about, which I did about 10 years into my tour life, my backhand went off and I wasn't able to get it back, really. I wasn't able to recover. It was kind of, I became a yippy stroke. And my skills started to leave me. And that was, for me, a huge loss because that's the coin of my realm. And I went into depression. I didn't know what it was. You know, they didn't know as much about it back then in the 70s as they do now, nor could they treat it as well. So I just knew that I was out of sync with everything and everybody. I was irritable all the time. I had a hard time sleeping. Worked harder at my game with no better results. Drank a little bit too much to quell the depression pain. And really, just as I look back, I mean, it was a miserable last 6 or 7 years of the regular tour. And then I became good at golf. I played a golf tour in the 90s and early 2000s, and it was a celebrity tour, but we played for prize money. It was real tournaments, real golf.
Mm-hmm.
And when my game went off, when my golf game went off in the 90s, it was like I was reliving the horror of what I had gone through with my tennis. And I basically had a 3-year breakdown and didn't know whether I'd make it back. Now, once I recovered and I went into therapy for a year, had counseling, went on medication. A lot of people don't realize what medication is. It's not a cover pill. It's to correct a chemical imbalance if you have one, and your doctor can advise you on that. But once I got into recovery and felt better and got back into the stream of life and playing golf tournaments again and playing well, and then I did 2 books, I thought, you know, I could help somebody because I want to tell my story. I thought, well, I don't know. I don't want to do that, though, because I don't want people thinking that I'm rehashing an old worn-out tennis career that was years ago. But then I thought how bad the disease is, and I still battle it. It's, you know, it's a chronic disease. I thought, if I can help just one person. So I called my daughter. She's got her PhD in comparative literature from Princeton. Mm-hmm. And we sat down, and my intent with the book was to obviously tell some good tennis stories, but I wanted people to know the bottom line on my book, Acing Depression, is that you do have hope in this life when you feel like you've lost everything. When you're really down and dirty with clinical depression, so I want people to know there's hope. I'm living proof that there is, and it's a bona fide disease. And there is a lot more help out there now than there ever has been before, and people need to seek that help. But I like to be the instrument of hope. I have overcome it. I still live with it. I'm never going to be completely free of it, but I now have a new normal and a creative life again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great backstory there, Cliff. We're talking with Cliff, you know, Cliff Richey, former number one player in the 70s and world ranked for many, many, many years in the 60s and 70s, talking about his life in his book called Acing Depression. It seems, Cliff, that a lot of pros, maybe they don't, maybe they go through a similar thing when their skill level is kind of dropping off because their identity is wrapped up in their performance, on the stage, so to speak. So you feel that this could be common with many other players or athletes at a high skill level that are maybe, you could give them some hope as well, as you just mentioned?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about what you just said, that there are many out there. If you look at the population in general, at any one given time, there's probably 7 to 10 to 12%, depending on the figures and the stats you look at, people that have active depression. And as a matter of fact, I won't name names, but an announcer on the Tennis Channel called me a few months ago, and he's in the process of trying to put together some help in some form. We're trying to figure out a platform to help maybe the ATP players who do have a problem and they don't know who to go to. And so I'm in the process right now of potentially helping the Association of Tennis Professionals do something that would be of help. There's no doubt that in a, you know, golf, any pro sport where, you know, a pitcher in baseball that's, you know, throwing motion goes off, we know what the stats are. We know what the statistics are in normal civilian life, so to speak. And there's at least as many in pro sports, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you're on a different stage. Most people, they go to work and they don't have, like, you know, 10,000 people watching them while they're, you know, in a desk on, you know, on an adding machine. So it's a different kind of a mental and, you know, spiritual inside. Can you, we're getting, you know, have a few more minutes left here. Can you also speak about, if you were the tennis czar or commissioner, that there was such a thing, because, you know, we've heard different stories about, you know, again, this is, I'm trying to get political on it, but if I was the USTA, I don't know if I would have put 100 courts in Orlando. I probably would have put 2 courts in 50 cities rather than 100 courts in one city, but that's another story. But can you, if you were the commissioner of tennis, if there was such a thing, what are some of the things that you would do to have the same experience or similar experience in the kind of motivation and direction and encouragement from that you had from your dad? How can that be duplicated? This is probably, maybe there's probably lots of other Cliff Richies out there, but maybe just don't have the shot at it like you did.
Well, you know, you're asking the question, why don't we have more top tennis players from the United States? And Andy Roddick was the last American man to win a Grand Slam, and that was 18 years ago. That's hard to believe. You know, you're asking a question that I blame the USTA partly, because obviously, and when I say I blame them, they're doing something wrong, or we'd have more winners. On the other hand, you know, it goes in spells like that. They've thrown money at it. They've hired big league, big names to try to do national programs. I think what you said is a little bit more probably you might want to look at, and rather than have one huge center, put in some centers in 10 or 12 different parts of the country, hire some good coaches, and let people do that. I don't know. It's crazy that we haven't had more top men players in particular that have risen into the. I don't think we have one player in the top 15 right now in the world. It might even be the top 20. But it is a shame,
yeah,
because, yes, there are a lot of Cliff Richies or Arthur Ashes or, you know, out there that would love to do it, but something's not right. Something's not happening.
Yeah, it seemed, I was fortunate to coach in Israel at the first tennis center there, and I. Now they have 14 centers and all privately funded primarily, but there was a different level of appreciation and gratitude rather than that I saw, because these are kids that are, you know, the only tennis centers in the world I know of that have bomb shelters, you know, because of the terrorists, you know, throwing.
Wow.
But in other words, we take a lot in this country for granted, and you know the appreciation.
Absolutely.
Just like when Djokovic's parents, his country was being bombed, they sent him to up to Nicky Pillich in Germany. And after the first week, Djokovic wanted to come back. He didn't think Pillich was working him hard enough. He didn't want to take advantage of what the parents had. His parents had to mortgage everything to help improve. And he's, you know, but it's very hard to recreate that situation with that kind of like, an internal drive and internal motivation that goes way beyond what you can duplicate in this country. But it seems like I kind of agree. I just wanted to ask that question. You compare it to other situations.
Yeah, if you look at the women's golf tour, they have a lot of Koreans. They're waiting in line over there for jobs, and in other words, they're hungry. They're hungry. If you look at the tennis players in the last 20 years, we've had a lot from the as you just said, from the old Russian Empire. You know, the Czechoslovakias and Serbias. And the bottom line is that you can't make it to the top or make it to the tour unless you're very hungry. And as you said. Appreciate the fact that you can do it, but you got to have that hunger, and you can throw money at it all day long, but I don't know that you can create hunger if it's not there. So I don't know, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%, agree on that. We're getting close to the finish of the interview today. Really appreciate your time and your insight. Is there, you have another or like a closing message for the listener, and we'll get you the copy of the interview after it's finished. We'll send you and your wonderful publisher, Randy, the link to it, so we can continue to get this out there more. Do you have a closing comment on your career, your journey, or anything else you wanted to add?
I will just repeat what I said a while ago. I just want people to know there's hope. It's an awful disease that takes your hope away. Clinical depression is very treatable. It's something that is a devil when you have it. But if people that are listening to this can hear that there is hope and to seek help, even if you have to do it in a clandestine way, go up the back stairs of a psychiatrist's office if you have to, but seek help. Unfortunately, we're not at the point yet that we can have it destigmatized. So I'm kidding when I say go up the back steps, but I'm also serious. Whatever it takes to seek help, go seek help and know and study it. Get to know what the disease is. Get to where you know why it's coming at you. So hope. I want to give people hope.
Yeah, well, I agree with you 1,000%. They have trainers and athletic trainers and therapists for – you know, you hurt your ankle, but this is another type of a hurt that you don't see, but is you're spot on with having the resources visibly out there. So people that I agree. So people don't think it's that you have to hide behind it.
Right. Exactly.
So again, we appreciate you coming on today, Cliff, and look forward to the next visit. And again, this is Cliff Ritchie, a wonderful, iconic player, and continued today, and from the 70s and 60s, and iconic Davis Cup player and beyond, and played some of the top players that ever lived, back in the day with all the top Aussies that you had to play against. That was quite a feat just by doing that in his powerful book, Acing Depression. So we appreciate your time today, Cliff, and we'll get you the interview archive after it's a little bit later on.
Very good, Tom. I have enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you again. Look forward to the next visit. And this is Tom,
bye-bye.
Healthy Referral, Mind Your Body and Spirit Radio Show. Mind Your Body and Spirit Radio Show signing off. And thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.